Support for this public radio podcast comes from Thrivent Financial, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thriventfinancial.com/retirement.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Economic times are tough these days, but for some, they're tougher than others.
Just about everything we do and touch with our business has seen a market increase in cost.
That's Clint Hickman with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. Clint says his costs are rising and so is the price of his product. Here's the question, what does Clint do? Is he A, the head of Frontier Airlines? They filed for bankruptcy this week in the face of rising fuel costs. Or is Clint B, chief of the National Association of Home Builders? Even the copper wiring in homes is getting pricey. Or maybe he is C, one of America's biggest egg farmers. The cost of feed for his hens shot up 50% this year. Only one choice is true, extra credit if you get it right. Find out which one on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. High gas prices? You could try public transportation. Record gold prices? You don't need that tennis bracelet. High food prices? What? You don't eat? I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
Take a walk through the aisles of your local supermarket, and one thing is glaringly obvious. Prices are soaring for the stuff we eat. According to some estimates, we're facing the worst case of food inflation in nearly 20 years. A couple of our responses, well, we cut back on restaurant meals, heat up more leftovers, buy fewer name-brand grocery items. But there's at least one commodity that's got farmers and eaters scrambling for answers. Marketplace sustainability reporter Sarah Gardner attempted to crack the price of eggs and discovered a whole lot of ingredients.
What are you making this morning?
A delicious sausage and cheese omelet.
Tempting, but I don't eat eggs anymore. Cholesterol problem. But my husband, don't get me started. He's back on one of his low-carb kicks. Instead of cereal, it's eggs every morning.
Do you know how much those eggs cost?
No, I don't have a clue.
Well, I'll tell you. $3.30 a dozen. I pay more than the national average because, well, everything costs more in L.A. Also because I'm lazy and get my eggs delivered to my door. But a few years ago, I was paying about half the price, like everybody else. What's clucking? That's the canned sound of hens, by the way. Getting into a hen house these days is like getting an audience with the Pope. The reason? Biosecurity. Farmers don't want visitors unknowingly tracking in germs that might infect the flock. So I called Clint Hickman in Arizona. He's one of the biggest egg farmers in the country. As long as I didn't get near his hens, he was happy to talk to me.
Just about everything we do and touch with our business has seen a market increase in cost.
The biggest increase? Chicken feed, which gobbles up at least 60% of an egg farmer's budget. Maybe we should stop using chicken feed as slang for a trifling amount of money, because it's doubled in price over the last year.
It's over 3 pounds, almost 4 pounds of feed to produce a dozen eggs.
Hickman says chicken feed's pricier mostly because it's full of corn. Corn used to be boring. Now farmers compete for it, along with ethanol producers, so the price is soaring. And of course, getting the feed to the hens costs more too. The truck driver carrying those eggs to the market is paying $1.25 a gallon more for diesel than he did last year. That raises wholesale costs, says Ephraim Liebtag. He's an agricultural economist at the USDA.
You know, we have a system of food distribution that's predicated on mass distribution and relatively cheap transportation costs, which that's changing now.
But every food producer in the country is squawking about fuel and corn prices. Egg prices have flown up more than most foods, 45% in the last 8 months. Unscramble that one, economists. Turns out demand is outstripping supply at this moment in egg history. See, farmers cut back on production a few years ago when prices were weak. Now that demand's high and supply is still pretty low, egg farmers are enjoying a decent profit.
They're reluctant to go back to the bad times. They certainly enjoy the good times.
Consultant Don Bell says farmers were scratched in the past when they expanded production too quickly. They're taking it slow this time. They're worried about the political climate, too. Listen to this ad.
Did you hear Wendy's is using eggs from hens kept in tiny cages?
Yeah, those poor birds can barely move their whole lives.
That's Animal horrible. Welfare advocates have been rattling the industry's cages over its hen houses. The upshot? There's now a little more space for each bird.
So if you have fewer hens in a hen house, you're going to have fewer eggs.
Mitch Head, an industry spokesman, said farmers are also reluctant to invest in new hen houses when some states may ban them in favor of cage-free egg farming. So supply is tight. And demand? Think Egg Foo Young. The rest of the world, including China, is now competing for our eggs, and they're bidding up prices. Even the Netherlands buys some of our eggs because the weak dollar makes them so cheap. Ephraim Liebtag.
Any countries that have rising income and growth rates that are faster than the current U.S. level will be looking for an expanded diet, and that would include importing meat and protein products. And what's interesting about eggs is it's one of the relatively cheaper protein sources.
The United Egg Producers won't soft-boil it for you. They expect prices to remain high as long as fuel and feed costs do, too. So if eggs are still your breakfast of choice, you can always stretch an egg with cheap filler, the penny pinchers say. Potato and onion omelet, anybody? In Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. And by gather.com, where people can stay in touch with who they know and what they love. You can discover unsigned musicians, discuss books, share pictures, and keep up with the world. People are talking. Gather.com.
This week, Bank of America and a unit of Citigroup joined a raft of student loan providers backing away from that market. The nation's largest student loan provider, Sallie Mae, warned of a pending train wreck in the $85 billion business. But the credit crunch is also affecting students who are about to graduate. Jobs are harder to find, and that means no income and no health care. Stephen Finan is with the American Cancer Society. This week he testified before Congress about the problems of obtaining health insurance. And let me ask you first, what are your options if you're just out of school and jobless?
Well, if you're a student, a full-time student, you have the possibility and option of remaining as a dependent on a parent's plan. But if you are not a full-time student and you do not have a job, or at least a job with employer-sponsored insurance, you essentially only have one option, and that is to seek health insurance coverage in the non-group or individual market.
Essentially, if you are not actively in school, you can't stay on your parents' insurance?
Generally, under the Internal Revenue Code, you lose your dependent status when you turn 19. Or if you remain a full-time student, you can remain a dependent until age 22. In some states, they have extended that coverage until 25, and a few states are even pushing it as high as 29.
All right. Well, let's assume that your only option is to buy yourself some individual health insurance. Is there a general idea of how much a 21, 22-year-old recent college graduate who does not have a job yet might pay monthly in premiums?
It's virtually impossible. I think at the low end, for a 20-year-old who is in good health, a male may pay as little as $1,200 or $1,300 a year, but the high end, it could be thousands of dollars a year.
I don't know if you would think of this as a trend, but we've noticed something with some insurance companies. They're really marketing specialized healthcare plans to young people. I've seen one that even almost looks like an iPod ad. Are these types of plans a good option?
Well, they are becoming increasingly common. The largest group of uninsured Americans are the young, those between age 19 and 25 and 26. Some large insurance carriers are starting to develop plans and market specifically to them. Although they are cheap, the quality of the insurance is questionable. It's not uncommon, for example, to have a limit, a total benefit limit of, say, $25,000. Which sounds a lot, but then the young person has to consider the possibility, what happens if I'm in a motorcycle accident? Then that person is virtually unprotected.
So what are the basic elements of a good plan for someone at that age?
You want to make sure you have good coverage for hospitalization. There's good coverage for doctors and providers, both inpatient and outpatient. And you want coverage for prescription drugs. Prescription drugs can be phenomenally expensive, and many plans today don't cover prescription drugs. Or if they do, the coinsurance or copays on them can be extremely high.
Stephen Finan is Associate Director of Policy at the American Cancer Society. Thanks so much for your help today.
Well, thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And Chris, you know, don't you, that California is the center of the world?
You and your colleagues have informed me of that many, many times. So yes, I'm aware of this.
Trends do start here. And this week, we heard a proposal from a state assemblyman. And to be clear, this is just a proposal. But he's talking about getting all California workers into a retirement savings plan.
Tess, this proposal really grabbed my attention. Because look, we know there are a lot of problems with our retirement savings system, and when you and I talk about it all the time. But the real disgrace is about half of the working people in this country don't have access to a 401k, a 403b, or, you know, a comparable plan at work. And here's a straight story. This proposal offers an efficient solution, even if it dies in the California legislature. I hope the idea sparks a national conversation and solution.
Well, let's talk about this proposal. Give us some details on how it would work.
Well, if it got passed, California would be the first state in the union that all its workers would have access to a portable retirement savings plan. So you have CalPERS, which is the giant plan for public employees in California, and it would create an IRA account for everybody. It would make it much easier for small businesses and for low-income employees to have a retirement savings plan.
Isn't this already available through something called the federal IRA?
Well, you and I can set up an IRA, absolutely, but we have to go do it.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that really makes the 401k and the 403b really work is it's automatic. The number of people who have come to me in April about setting up an IRA, I can guarantee you that about half of them next April are going to ask me the same question. So this way, you get that automatic payroll deduction. Plus, in this plan, employers could put a match.
What's the role of the state legislature in creating this new option when there already are options?
What intrigues me about this idea, and it's really one of the better ideas I've seen in a long time, is to try to address that half. Because that half that doesn't have access to a retirement plan at work, it's been around for quite a while. The mutual fund industry has been trying to reach out. But frankly, if I were the retirement czar, Chris Farrell, retirement czar,
I will appoint you as retirement czar for the next 2 minutes.
Well, I'd love the proposal. I first read about it from the late Robert Eisner, one of my favorite economists, which is on top of your Social Security account, we create a national 401k. In our system, probably not going to see that. So maybe we get California to do it, New York State, which doesn't like to be behind California, and then we end up with a federal system. Not everybody's going to put money in, but it's going to make it much easier for the low-income average person to save.
Well, there was an article in the LA Times about all this that had some pretty unhappy quotes from Wall Street.
Right.
The worry is that this could be unfair competition from the largest state-run pension plan.
Yeah. So, that's what's wrong with a little competition. I mean, I'm not worried about it. If Wall Street can come up with a better solution, that's fine with me.
All right. The straight story from our own Chris Farrell. And Chris, I only made you czar for a couple of minutes, but how about we extend that through the weekend?
I'm on that.
Cool.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
So more and more Americans are using their 401ks to pay the bills. We'll explore why that's an intensely bad idea. And here's evidence that age does not always equal wisdom.
My stepfather told me, if you want to make a lot of money, go into the theater business.
Right. A day in the work life of a theater owner. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vinklund. You may have noticed there's not a whole lot of good news in the show. Well, let's keep going with that, shall we? This week, Washington Mutual reported first quarter losses of $1.1 billion. The nation's largest saving and loan is chin deep in the subprime mortgage mess. It's also feeling the effects of customers falling behind on their bills. Delinquency rates are at a 16-year high on everything from home loans and credit cards to car payments. Cash-strapped Americans are looking for money anywhere they can find it. Last year, nearly 20% of employees took out loans from their 401ks. Those numbers are climbing. Josephine Bennett tells us that once you tap into retirement funds, it can be tough to pay yourself back.
There are two ways you can take money out of your 401k. You can take what's called a hardship withdrawal, or you can take out a loan. To qualify for a hardship withdrawal, you have to be facing what the IRS calls immediate and heavy financial needs, things like college tuition, medical expenses, buying your first home, or foreclosure. But if you're just short on funds, you can take out a low-interest loan against your 401k. Most employers allow people to take out up to $50,000. You have 5 years to pay it back, and those deductions come right out of your paycheck. 43-year-old Anjanette Rumney worked as a nurse in the same Macon, Georgia hospital for 15 years. During that time, she was a regular contributor to her 401k. The longer she worked, the more she saved.
You know, I started off with just like 5%, and then I went up to 7%. So I got up to about like 10% that I was saving, and then the medical center would match that. So I had a pretty good, you know, amount in there.
At one point, she had close to $100,000 in her retirement account. But as a single mother with two boys, she still struggled to make ends meet. So she borrowed money from her 401k to pay off bills. But then she changed jobs. And here's the catch. If you leave your job, the government only gives you 90 days to pay back the loan. If you don't, you'll be hit with taxes and a penalty. What seemed like a good idea became a bitter pill this year when she paid her taxes. Anjanette lost nearly half the amount in taxes and penalties.
As we all know that our economy, everything else is going up and your paycheck isn't. And then when I didn't get my money back that I was used to getting from my income taxes because I had to pay those penalties, you know, it was like, wow.
Anjanette does not regret her decision. She says she needed to do it to avoid a disaster down the road. 57-year-old John McIntyre has been a victim of corporate downsizing twice, and both times he's qualified for the 401k hardship withdrawal.
I had to do it. There was no other way. I really couldn't take out any loans at the time. When was I going to start to work? Was it going to be next week, next month, 3 months, 5 months? And being at the age I was at, I was close to 50. It was much more difficult to find a job.
As a result of those withdrawals, he'll have to work a lot longer than he expected. He's just starting to put a little back in savings. Certified financial planner Steve Rosenberg knows people often have to make tough choices under fire, but he cautions his clients not to let emotions get in the way, even if they're about to lose a home.
If you are facing foreclosure and effectively the house is worth less than what you owe on it, then do you want to take the money out of your 401k, which is protected from suits and things like that, and do you instead want to just walk away from the house?
Rosenberg cautions his clients against borrowing from their 401ks. He points to the current housing crisis as an important lesson.
The problem is that people are treating their 401ks like they treat like a bank. And we know that's a bad idea because there's already a model that shows how bad an idea that is. And that's people who have taken money out of their houses, refinanced, took out the money, spent it, and they've blown their equity in their houses. You know, if they take it out of their 401k, they end up blowing their 401k too.
But with $49 billion in outstanding 401k loans, it's clear that many Americans are willing to take that risk. In Macon, Georgia, I'm Josephine Bennett for Marketplace Money.
Over the past few years, banks went crazy promoting home equity lines of credit, also known as HELOCs. If you're a homeowner, you probably got your share of notices promising to turn your house into an ATM. Or maybe you've seen these tempting ads on TV.
Have a major expense coming up? A home equity loan could be the answer.
Need a smart way to handle your debt?
No fees with a minimum $10,000 home equity loan, and we'll finance up to 100% of your home's equity.
A low-rate home equity loan can keep you out of the doghouse.
This is Bob. He used the equity to pay off his bills, and he's saving a bundle every month on his house payment.
Well, as we've said before, banks are more than a little nervous these days. And now they're sending out another kind of notice, one that says they're freezing your HELOC account. What to do? To help us sort it out is Carolyn Bigda of Money Magazine. Carolyn, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
How are people finding out about this? Are they literally just getting a letter in the mail saying you don't have this credit line anymore?
That's exactly how it's happening. You know, one day you have it, the next you go to your mailbox and you open the letter and it says something has changed in your credit score or your home value is no longer as high as it once was, and so you can no longer access your line of credit.
If the banks are lowering or eliminating these credit lines based on falling home values, where are they getting the numbers for those falling values? Surely they're not sending out assessors everywhere.
Oh, of course not. No, they're looking at a broader level, looking at county data, basing this on zip codes. And if they see sort of a general trend in your neighborhood, in the area that you live, then that triggers the alert to them, and then they start sending out the letters.
What happens if you are literally in the middle of a project? You know, you've got the contractor all ready to go, and he's already been working on things, and all of a sudden you don't have money to pay for the rest of it.
Yeah, that's a very difficult situation, and it's the same with a lot of parents who were maybe planning on tapping their line of credit to send their kids to college this fall. In some cases, it may be advisable to, if you're afraid of having your line of credit frozen, to actually withdraw that money in one lump sum now and put it in a savings account.
Oh, so actually take it out of the line of credit and put it somewhere else so you actually have it?
Yeah, exactly. If you think that you could be at risk of this, especially if you live in an area where home values have declined rapidly, you could be a good risk for this. And so you might want to withdraw that money, being aware that now you're reducing the equity in your home and you're also going to have to pay interest on that money. But if you really need it, you could withdraw that in one lump sum and put that in a savings account.
Are we finding at all that this is hurting people's credit score?
Exactly. That is a concern that consumers should be aware about, because if all of a sudden your credit limit has dropped on your credit profile, then you look like you're tapping or maxing out, really, all the credit that's available to you. So if that's the case, then you might talk with your lender to see if you can get part of that credit limit reinstalled, or to think seriously now about paying down that credit line.
What else should you do if you've received one of these letters from your HELOC provider?
Contact a local realtor and pull prices for homes sold within 3 miles of your home within the last 6 months and show what the values are of homes in your neighborhood. If the lender is saying, you know, there's been a drop in your credit score and that's the reason for the freeze, pull your credit reports or get your credit scores and see what those numbers are. Again, the lenders are kind of taking sweeping actions here, and they're not going, in most cases, home by home to see what your credit score is at or what your home's value really is.
Carolyn Bigda is a reporter for Money Magazine. Thanks so much for your help today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
All right, it's time for Getting Personal, where we turn around the mic. And with me, of course, is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello again, Chris.
Yes, I'm back, Tess. And boy, I'm eager for these questions.
Okay, let's go to caller number one. And Karen is with us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Karen.
Hey, how are you?
We're doing well. What do you do there in D.C.?
I work for the government doing strategic planning work.
Strategic planning work. What does that mean?
We do an analysis of the research we fund, and then we plan what we need to do in the out years.
Okay. Well, tell us what your question is for Chris today.
I tutor and mentor a young woman who's a junior in high school, and she, a couple weeks ago, decided that she wants to go to college. So I would like to start up some sort of fund or account so that I can help pay for her tuition. And I know there are 529 accounts, and I don't know if that is something I should consider, and if there's absolutely any way I could get a tax break out of this.
Wow. Well, first of all, Karen, good for you. This is quite an effort on your part. You said that she is in what grade?
She's in the 11th grade.
In the 11th grade. So you don't have a whole lot of time to save for her. Chris, does that have an impact on what you will recommend in terms of being able to put some money aside for the student?
Yes, absolutely. One is I would just put the money into brand name money market mutual fund. You'll get whatever low interest rate that's being offered right now, and your money will be safe. You retain flexibility, and it may be that some of the savings isn't needed, in which case you still have it for your own use. Second point is I can't think of a tax-advantaged savings account for you that is going to save you on your taxes, and particularly in light of what you want to use with this money in this short-term time frame.
So, Chris, it's not worth it for her to do a 529?
You know, I don't think so because, you know, let's say you put some money aside, but then it isn't really needed or it isn't needed as much. It's more of a sense of maintaining maximum flexibility with the savings. It may all go toward the young woman or maybe only a portion goes to the young woman. So that's why I'm recommending the money market mutual fund. Now, my other part is, and this comes from an interview I did, seven, 8 years ago, and it was with the head of financial aid at University of California, Berkeley. His argument was, and my argument would be, money's not the really big issue. The real issue is making sure that she's done the college prep courses and being her advocate and understanding what kind of college she can go to, what kind of financial aid is available, what sort of grants are out there, and to understand the information and to expose her to and show her what are her options.
Yeah, and we've been talking a lot about that lately. And fortunately, the tutoring program we work through has quite a resource center for information about financial aid. So that makes the whole world a little less scary for me there.
Well, thank you for helping this young woman out. And does that help you answer your question?
Yes, it does, quite a bit.
Okay, terrific. Well, best of luck to you and to the young woman you're tutoring.
Okay, thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, let's reach into the email bag, and Casey writes in from Wichita, Kansas, and he has a little in common with Karen. He's a young professional who's been saving money fanatically. He feels like he has his personal savings picture under control. He says when he was growing up, his mother sacrificed a good deal of her disposable income helping him to get to where he is now, and he would like to find some way to essentially pay her back. He'd like to put a small amount of money away each month into a retirement fund for her. So, Chris, what is the best way for him to do this? And again, much like Karen, he's wondering if there are any tax implications.
Well, what I would do, and I think it's just wonderful what he wants to do, I would open up an account at one of the major mutual fund companies with their tax-managed accounts. And the whole idea behind them is they limit your tax bill on a yearly basis. So they understand that when they sell securities, you know, it'll trigger a capital gains event that you end up having to pay for. The other thing, and it's a little bit of a variation, just as his question is a variation on Karen's question,
mm-hmm.
variation on my answer. Part of what young people can do for their parents, if it's worth it, pay for a several-time visit with a certified financial planner to look at your mom's portfolio. And another thing to do is gather information. And in the internet age, you know, there's a lot of good information out there, but it's hard to gather. So does your mom want to stay at home? What are some of the services that will enable her to stay at home? In really trying to help continue to lead the life that they want to lead.
All right. Hope that helps you out, Casey. And thanks so much for writing in. Well, if you've got questions, hopefully we've got some answers for you. Do give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. And we are taking your questions every single weekday online. Go to marketplace.org and click on Getting Personal. And we'll have more Getting Personal with Chris later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. The fourth most popular DVD rental this week is Sweeney Todd. That bloody movie musical is based, of course, on Stephen Sondheim's Broadway show of the same name. It's raked in millions on stage and on screen, but most live theaters in the U.S. have, shall we say, more humble financial expectations. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we meet the owner of an off-Broadway theater. The biggest drama in his life? Staying in the black.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Could everyone please take this moment to turn off your cell phones and remember no flash photography during the show. And now please welcome to the stage your host for this evening.
My name's Peter Martin. I'm 43, and I'm the owner of the Triad Theater in New York City. My stepfather told me, if you want to make a lot of money, go into the theater business, which which I've never really heard anybody else repeat after that. Apparently at the time, I had some friends, I guess, invested in some shows and had done very well. The first show I ever worked on was incredibly successful, and I saw with a small investment, you can make these huge returns. Probably that happens one out of every 400, 500 shows off Broadway. It's very, very rare. But I thought, hey, this is a great business. I mean, the most controversies we've had is dealing with the Jewish Theater of New York. They did a show called The Last Virgin, and I didn't really know much about the type of works they do. The show dealt with suicide bombers, and this is soon after 9/11. A couple of New York City intelligence squad officers came up to talk to us, and I was like amazed how they even knew about the show. And so they put out riot barriers, and one of the other shows they did a couple of years ago was called Kabbalah, and that starred Emily Stern. And at some point, the actors all get nude for about 10-15 minutes. Turns out Emily Stern was Howard Stern's daughter, and he was on the Larry King show. And the first question Larry asked Howard was, how do you feel about your daughter being nude in the show Kabbalah at our theater? So it caused quite a bit of controversy. The goal when you're producing theater or originating a new production in New York is you want to have subsidiary rights where you can take the show that started at this theater and be able to sell it to other cities, even to take it to other countries. And that's where the real monies can be made in theater. But that's hard to do. You really need a unique product that can run in New York for quite a while. Best thing I did 13 years ago was we purchased the building. If we didn't purchase the building, I would say we'd probably not still be here today. People have to get gas, they have to eat food. Theater is a total discretionary type of purchase, and they certainly don't have to go see an off-Broadway show. Most tourists want to see Broadway, so it's a little bit of a tougher marketing challenge. Unless you have a special real estate situation, you can probably expect to make nothing, because your expenses are so great that it would be hard to make money. So in the best of times, could have maybe made $100,000 in 1 year, and other years, $30,000, $50,000, $60,000. Gerald Schoenfeld, the head of the Schubert, told a general manager, Lee Summers, that theater is the great liberator. It liberates wealthy people from their money.
We've got more about Peter Martin and his theater at marketplace.org. A Day in the Work Life was reported by Julie Miller. Coming up, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. Yeah, you heard of them. What do they really do? And New York City unveils its Office of Financial Empowerment.
The experiment that we're engaged in, which is really incredibly exciting, is when you put that mission inside of city government and you can pull the levers from within, what can you accomplish?
And you are listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Last month, the left coast and the right coast decided it was time to work together. New York and San Francisco announced a new coalition that they titled Cities of Financial Empowerment. Miami, San Antonio, Savannah, and Seattle are also part of the effort. It's designed to help low and moderate income residents improve their financial health and security. And as Elisa Roth tells us, it all comes out of a Big Apple initiative that started last year.
The Office of Financial Empowerment sounds like something out of a second-rate science fiction book. It's actually a new part of New York City's Department of Consumer Affairs. Jonathan Mintz runs the agency. He thinks it's nothing short of revolutionary.
For the first time, city government has taken in-house a mission that I think many people feel is reserved to the not-for-profit sector.
That is, to get financial education and information to low- and middle-income residents. New York's one-stop shop is the first of its kind in the country. Some nonprofits do financial education. Others focus on helping people get all the public benefits they can. Mintz wants to do it all, and then some.
But how do you actually help people move ahead financially?
He thinks the city's uniquely positioned to do that.
And so the experiment that we're engaged in, which is really incredibly exciting, is when you put that mission inside of city government and you can pull the levers from within, what can you accomplish?
Hello? Hey, Mama.
Christine Shimelis is one example. She's a single mother who is thrilled to learn she could get paid for doing things like taking her kids to the doctor for physicals or for meeting with their teachers.
Because, of course, raising three kids, the money does come in handy. And it was things that I was already doing with my kids.
To get that money, she signed up for the office's best-known program, Opportunity NYC. It's a cash incentive scheme which started last year. It pays low-income New Yorkers for doing ordinary things, such as getting a library card or finding a job. The trick, Mintz explains, is to get people to
build not only in a way that allows for their present to make sense, dealing with debt, dealing with their current crises of the day or the week. But what's also important is to help people begin to build toward a future.
Mintz admits these are the kinds of things nonprofits have been trying for ages. But he says the city has the clout and the contacts with nonprofits, think tanks, and state and local agencies to really make a difference. It's also got leverage with the business community. Working with poor people is good PR for companies like banks, and there's always the possibility of more business for them down the line. For example, when the city started Opportunity NYC, it convinced 10 banks and credit unions to create a special bank account for participants. San Francisco's been watching New York's new office closely. Jose Cisneros is treasurer of San Francisco and co-directs the New Cities for Financial Empowerment Coalition. He says a city has credibility with its residents, too. If a bank suggests opening an account, people might suspect it's just looking to make a quick buck. Coming from the city, it's less threatening.
When they hear that message from me, the treasurer, the New York City Office of Financial Empowerment, neither of us are looking to get any business. We're not going to gain or profit from them moving in from going from check cashing to a bank account at a bank or a credit union.
And he may just be right. More than half the New Yorkers who signed up for Opportunity NYC have opened new bank accounts. For the moment, New York's is still the only office of financial empowerment, but other cities are moving in similar directions. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
False hopes bring us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, rescue scam. That's when thieves promise to help struggling homeowners avoid foreclosure, but actually they're just trying to steal people's equity or even their entire house. These scams come in a few forms, like phantom counseling, when companies charge a fee for negotiating a repayment plan, then vanish. There's also the bailout, where you're convinced to sign over the house's title with the promise that you'll be able to buy it back, which never happens. According to a report released this week, one in 33 homes are projected to go into foreclosure. And many consumer advocates say millions of Americans might fall for these rescue scams. Sad, but true.
We're back with Getting Personal, the cure for your financial ills, prescribed by our own money doctor, Chris Farrell. And Chris, our next call comes from Lita, and she is in Lincoln, Nebraska. Hi, Lita.
Well, hello.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. What do you do there in Nebraska?
Well, I have reached that magical age where I have to take my minimum required distribution from my retirement savings.
Dare I ask how old that makes you?
Dare I ask how old you are? All right, come on. If you're going to make me fess up, you better do it, too.
Well, in fact, it is my birthday this weekend, and I am turning...
Well, happy birthday for you.
Thank you. Thank you.
The magic age is 70.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how I got there. I turned around. I said, no, it's impossible. But happy birthday to you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And so what is your question for Chris now that you've reached this magical age?
Well, actually, I have two questions. Well, first of all, a woman who tell you her age will tell you anything, so I'm going to tell you this. I have accounts all over the place, I've got 401ks and supplemental retirement accounts and annuities and yada-da-da-da. Now, I have not yet rolled these over into IRAs, and I heard your program a few weeks ago that said you recommended that be done, but I have yet to do that.
Okay.
Should I take my required percentage out of each of the account, or should I take it out of the smaller accounts and eliminate them forever? That's the how, and the when is, when should I take it? Monthly or quarterly or annually? So I asked my CPA this, and he said, well, just take it once a year. And I said, but why would I want to do that? Because now the money is not in the market compounding. He said, it's just easier.
Well, Chris, this is a really good question, and I think it's a very common one. It's really hard to figure out how much money you should be taking out once you've retired. But let's deal with the first question, which is the idea of consolidation. Chris, I'm guessing you are going to suggest absolutely move all these small accounts into one simple place.
That's what I would recommend. Just ease of bookkeeping. And it just also makes it easier to see where your money is and what your overall portfolio is. But just to throw in one wrinkle, in their wisdom, the people who write these rules treat IRAs and 401ks differently. So with your IRAs, when you're doing your required minimum distribution, you take all your IRA accounts, you throw them in the one pot, and then you look at the IRS life expectancy tables, and you figure out how much you have to take out. Then you can take it out from any IRA account that you want. So you want to get rid of the small ones? No problem. With your 401k plan, let's just say you had three 401k plans. You have to withdraw your required minimum distribution from each of those plans. You can't aggregate them together. From each one with a 401k, but with the IRA, it doesn't matter which one you take it out of. And then to the second part of your question, most of us have lived in a world where we get a regular paycheck. And it's kind of hard to manage money. I don't know about you, but if I got all my money in, say, January, I'd be eating really well in January and I'd be on ramen noodles by December. And so one advantage of the technology age that we're in and putting the money with an IRA is they'll pay you any way you want. You want it monthly? Do you want it quarterly? What makes your life the easiest? You know, for me, I'd probably just go for it monthly just because that's the way I'm used to living.
So, Lita, what are you planning to do with this money as you withdraw it?
Pay for my gas bill.
Okay. Well, that'll eat up most of it, I'm sure.
I'll use it all to pay for my gas bill and food. Bananas just went up to 79 cents a pound.
Oh, my goodness.
I about had apoplexy when I saw that.
Well, I hope you're having fun as well.
Oh, I am. I'm going to invest in golf lessons and give Tiger Woods, or now the new guy who just won Immelman, a run for his money.
All right. We'll look forward to seeing you at Augusta.
And I will look forward to being seen, but green is not my best color.
Oh, well, maybe
so
they'll...
Maybe they change it to red for Nebraska, and we could go big red.
I think they might do that for you. Thanks so much for the call.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Well, if you need help creating your own perfect retirement, then look us up on our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link, or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right, back to the emails, and Ben wrote in from Evansville, Indiana, and he was listening to last week's show and caught part of our financial quiz, specifically this question posed to our own Nancy Fargali. Chelsea worked her way through college, earning $15,000 per year. After graduation, her first job pays $30,000. The total dollar amount Chelsea will have to pay in federal income taxes in her new job will A, double, at least from when she was in college, B, it will go up a little from when she was in college, C, stay the same as when she was in college, or D, be lower than when she was in college.
Can I ask a few questions? So she made $15,000 when she was in college, mm-hmm. which meant she had no taxable income.
All right, so Ben wants to know, and we're going to set aside the actual numbers from the question here, but he wants to know if Nancy was correct when she was talking about not being taxed on this figure. And the reason he wants to know is because he's a college student. He makes around $3,000 a year, and his employer has not been taking any money out of his paychecks for taxes. So is he going to owe?
All right, now, if you're making $3,000 a year, I went to the IRS website. It has a really nice interactive feature where you can figure out whether or not you have to file. If you're making $3,000 a year, you don't have to file federal income taxes. However, I would recommend filing. One, this year, that thing you talk about all the time, Tess.
The stimulus check.
The stimulus check. All right. So you want to file if you want to get your stimulus check. And at $3,000 a year, you'll probably qualify for a minimal amount, but, you know, probably get something.
But you say he won't be paying taxes on $3,000.
That's right. You just file.
Okay. All right. Well, that's all the time we have this week. But if you're still looking for answers, Chris is answering your personal finance questions online every weekday. Just visit our website. It's marketplace.org and click on the Getting Personal link. Or you can call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Now that tax season is over, there's nothing left to do but wait for that rebate check we just mentioned. But that's not the only gift Uncle Sam is handing out this year. The economic stimulus package also allows Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae to buy mortgages worth up to $729,750. So for those of us in really expensive parts of the country, it's supposed to mean cheaper home loans. But how does all this work? What exactly is the role of Fannie and Freddie anyway? For some answers, we turn to Susan Wachter at the Wharton School of Business. And let's start with the very basics. Are Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac different entities?
Historically, they were. Now, they are not. They are different corporations. They're owned by different shareholders. There are nuances of differences. But effectively, they have the same mission and they operate the same way.
Now, you talk about how they are corporations owned by shareholders, but we also almost always precede Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac with this phrase, government-sponsored entities. What does that mean?
They are implicitly guaranteed by the federal government. They have explicit statements that they are not guaranteed by the federal government, but there are many reasons, and markets assume that the federal government is standing behind them. Even in times of great turmoil, such as we see now, Fannie and Freddie mortgages, guaranteed mortgages, are quite stable.
Give us, in its most basic terms, an idea of what these companies actually do. They don't originate mortgages. They don't hand them out like a bank.
They absolutely do not originate mortgages. That is not in their charter. They are the entities that guarantee the funds that are coming from other investors, ultimately back to the banks who are providing the funds for mortgages. So a borrower goes in, seeks a mortgage. That mortgage is originated by the bank. But the bank ultimately does not fund a Fannie Freddie guaranteed mortgage. What the bank does, that mortgage plus a lot of others are pooled together in a Fannie, what's called a Fannie and Freddie security. Those securities are ultimately funded by secondary market investors, their pension funds, their insurance companies. Now, why are they providing these funds? In part because Fannie and Freddie are guaranteeing that their funds will be repaid.
Are there any subprime loans that were backed by Fannie and Freddie, or would that have been impossible?
That would have been impossible. Fannie and Freddie's mission makes it impossible. They can only guarantee investment grade, which does not include subprime mortgages.
Let's talk about Fannie and Freddie and the role that they play in this notion of conforming loans versus jumbo loans. Now, there is a number that is set, I believe, by Congress, above which you are a jumbo loan and below which you are what's called a conforming loan. How is this number set, first of all?
The number is set by Congress. Fannie and Freddie must abide. It has been until recently, as you say, 417,000. It does change slightly every year, but it basically has been within these numbers, a few percentage points lower every year. It has gone up, though, dramatically recently through congressional legislation.
And what is the difference, then, between a conforming loan and a jumbo loan? What do those mean for people?
Conforming loan means that they can be guaranteed by Fannie and Freddie. They conform to Fannie and Freddie's standards. So if your mortgage is qualified to be in a Fannie and Freddie mortgage-backed security, it means you are going to be paying substantially less for your mortgage.
In terms of an interest rate?
In terms of your mortgage payment, in terms of your interest rate, it will be substantially less.
And the reason behind Congress boosting this number under which you are a conforming loan, that's because so many states have median home prices that are and were way beyond the $417,000, right?
Absolutely. So in this recent, although now reversing, housing boom, which has caused housing prices in states like Florida and California to exceed the median price, to exceed the standard for conforming loans for Fannie and Freddie.
Both Fannie and Freddie got in trouble a couple of years ago for accounting scandals. And at that point, there was some talk in Congress about restricting them much more than had been the case. At this point, is all that kind of out the window?
In some ways it is. In fact, those restrictions which were put in place have been removed. And some of the talk is they've been removed because the accounting is better in place. But it's not just that. It's the reality is that right now we are depending on Fannie and Freddie to help get us out of the subprime mess.
Susan Wachter is professor of real estate and finance at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for helping us out today.
Thank you, Tess. It's a pleasure.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, Craigslist is a cheap way to hitch a car ride, but you got to be careful.
This guy sounded like scary, so forget about him. I mean, woman has this strong instinct, you know?
The ins and oh my's of digital hitchhiking. And a warm southern welcome to our new listeners on WJSU in Jackson, Mississippi. Glad to have you. Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas with Rico Galliano, Stephen Hoffman, James Richter, Michelle Phillippe, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Orr. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Viglund. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.